It's Wrestling Observer Radio. Garrett Gonzalez and Dave Meltzer here. Free show for everybody.
Cool.
So we, I'll give you a little bit of the lay of the land of the show. Earlier today, we were at the Marriott Hotel in downtown San Jose at the Bellator press event. And we talked to John Fitch and Ilima Leigh McFarlane.
Yeah.
They fight on Saturday for the Bellator show in San Jose. And so we have those interviews. We will play them in a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about WWE and the financials and whatever else news there is out there. And then after the interviews, we will kind of wrap up with kind of just to end the show. So that's Lay of the Land. Free podcast, tweet it out and share it with tons of people.
Yeah, they're really good interviews. That's one of the reasons why I'm like really happy with the show, because very, very different. I mean, John Fitch, we talked about a lot of different things, including, you know, why a guy who spent his whole career, you know, anti-steroids with a pretty strong moral code, you know, depression hit him, took steroids, explained why, pissed that he did. Explained how he thought he could get away with it and he didn't. But it's really interesting talking about that and talking about all the different things he's learned through different phases of, you know, killer training to smart training, from different types of attempts at diets.
Yeah, his diet absolutely changed over the years.
Many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and just different results from different diets. And here he's at 41 years old, fighting for the Bellator championship, coming off 5 straight wins. You know, I mean, and you know, going places, going, you know, starting in San Jose and ending up back in San Jose.
When they did the face-off with he and Rory, Rory looked really small to me.
They both looked light. But at least Fitch's
shoulders, you know, a little bit more defined. He's a little bit more muscular up top. Maybe it was just the t-shirt
It might have been the shirt.
He was just wearing a really tight t-shirt.
But Rory, you know, Rory is a lot smaller than he was when he was younger. You know, which may be, you know, changing the way you lift,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, because Fitch said the same thing. It's like, he used to lift heavy, lift to failure. And it's like, now you don't lift heavy. You just lift to kind of have strength.
Yeah. He just tries to get powerful lifts in and not worrying about, you know, repping to failure because he can't train as often when he does that.
Right. Because it hurts your regular training if you train that hard with the weights. It was interesting, you know, because here's a guy who's been, you know, I mean, probably like, about 18 years in the sport, 18, you know, something like that. And that's a long tenure. And
yep.
to still be in a championship position, you know, in a main event on a major show,
yep.
you know, at this stage. And then Ilima, you know, is just an interesting character, you know, real cool. And you know, I mean, I didn't know the stuff about, you know, she basically fell into the sport. This was not her. It called her. She didn't call it, and that's very rare.
Yeah, we'll save our recap for the end, so we don't spoil a lot of the details. But so talk me through the WWE financials. I've seen a lot of commentary. I've seen some things that Vince is using for excuses as to why, and
it's not good. And I mean, that's why. I mean, this was a big stock drop, and last night, you know, I said that like they probably weren't going to make money the first 3 quarters because they're spending a lot more, but I didn't expect and I expected small losses. You know, I think I said $700,000-$800,000 loss. Well, it ended up being over eight, you know, it's 8,396,000, but that's even misleading because the actual losses were 11.3 million and then the it got down to 8.4 million because the, you know, basic, you know, tax losses and everything mm-hmm. like that. So I mean, it went from last year, the first quarter was what's the number? It was 20 million in profit, but after taxes it was like 14. So it looks like it's from like plus 14 to minus 8, but it's really from plus 20 to minus 11. That's a giant turnaround. Now 12 million of that was executive bonuses because they had such a big year, you know, last year.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even so, that doesn't even come close to making up for it. And the revenue's a little bit down. The expenses are way up. I mean, it's nothing to panic over, but it actually, it's nothing to panic over from a financial standpoint. But what can't be ignored is the loss of popularity of the product is, accelerating, and it's worse than I thought. I mean, to me, the key, you know, I mean, the reason that the numbers are down, I mean, the network is about the same. It should be up. It's about the same. So the numbers actually, on March 31st and on WrestleMania Day, the number in both days was actually down from a year before, which has never happened. The growth for WrestleMania was basically about 100,000 less than the year before. So last year you were lower on December 31st, but you were higher on March 31st and higher on WrestleMania Day than this year. So essentially this year's WrestleMania did not excite people at anywhere close to the level of last year. Now, some of this may be a little misleading because if you remember last year, they inflated the numbers with all those $3 and, you know, those $3 3-month things, and they didn't do as much of this year. So some of that's explainable, but it's 100,000 difference. That's a big...
Does that mean we're going to see more of that?
Next year? Maybe. But that's also bad in the long run.
Yeah.
That's a short-term fix, and they don't need to do short-term fixes. But the other things, merchandise and live events, way down. The merchandise, the mail merchandise, you know, the e-commerce, WWE shop was down like 21% year over year. The live event merch was down somewhat because there were less shows, but it was also down per head significantly, you know, from like 1040 to 950-ish.
Do you remember what the shop zone number was for this year's Christmas as compared to, or last year's Christmas as compared to the previous? Was there a drop at all?
I have to look it up. I don't think there was a drop.
Mm.
If it was, it may have been even. But I don't think it was dry. If it was dropped, I think I would have remembered. But it's not a significant drop in this. So there's, you know, the gist of everything is this product's gotten really cooled off since January 1st. And probably, yeah, since January 1st, I guess is the best way to put it. Maybe since the Royal Rumble. Because the house show decline. So it looks on paper where the house shows went from last year at this point, 5,400 average per show. And for the first quarter, you really want 6,000. I mean, that's a usual number. So they were below usual last year. It was 4,800 this year, but that's really misleading because you had that Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome where they sold, you know, over 35,000 tickets. So if you factor out the Alamo Dome, you're really at 4,400. And last year, if you factor out Royal Rumble, you're at 5,300. So you really dropped on an average show from 5,300 to 4,400 with less shows, meaning more emphasis is on the big shows.
TV.
The TV tapings, which outdraw the house shows. So it's even worse then than it sounds. So the house shows, the house shows are significantly down. And this was after Vince did the thing talking about how, you know, last quarter, hey, we know the house shows are down, but we also know why and we also know how to fix it. And nothing's changed. And they've gone down even worse. You know, so the licensing is even. The network's, you know, really even. It's a little down right now, but it's even. Which should be up a little bit, but it's even. TV rights, of course, up. But it's the other things. You know, it's basically the house shows and the merchandise, and that's really the stuff. You know, that's the fan related. It's the you know, direct to consumer stuff. You know, not the non-fixed stuff. That's the stuff that's down.
So what was the spending, the overspending? Like, what did they actually spend?
They wouldn't say, but it's like, you know, I mean, I'm sure that they started spending because they know that in October they're going to be getting that giant increase in rights. Like, from a financial standpoint, I'm not the slightest bit worried about them and you know, for 5 years because there's too much TV money coming in. Their profits are going to be gigantic, even though, yeah, this was a bad quarter for profits. So it's nothing to worry about there, but the creative not clicking with the public is absolutely concerning. And it's, like I said, it's, I knew it was bad. I knew from the TV ratings it was bad. I followed the house shows real close. I knew it was down, but I didn't realize it was down as much. And I didn't realize that the merch, which is a key of the merch, is basically how over are your top guys, because those are the guys who sell the merch. And you know, a lot of this could be very simple. And it's John Cena being gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say Roman Reigns being gone, but Roman Reigns is back. And the reality is Roman Reigns is back, and we're, the TV ratings are lower than, you know, are declining at a faster rate than they were earlier. So Roman Reigns being gone was not the problem. John Cena being gone, John Cena being not in WrestleMania, you know, or not even on television for WrestleMania. You know, he just showed up that day. I think that, you know, Undertaker not being mentioned for WrestleMania, maybe the women's main event. I mean, because, you know, a lot of people are talking now that, like, you know, maybe it's that they focus so much on women. And I mean, the women were top, but okay, so Vince is out here talking about how we didn't have a lot of stars. Well, you had Roman Reigns back. You know, Seth did miss house shows, but they never told you that. There was never, you know what I mean? The fans going, that had no effect on the house shows because they told you Seth was still going to be there. And I don't think Seth's that, you know, I mean, Seth's great, but I don't think he's like a gigantic, you know, difference maker. But when we come, now, you know, he's talking about like all these stars were gone. Well, who is gone now is Ronda Rousey and Brock Lesnar, who are the, you know, I don't want to say they're the two biggest. I mean, mainstream wise, they are the two biggest stars, I would say.
And two of the highest paid stars that he has.
Yeah, that too.
But doesn't it, what does that mean though? It shows you that Brock and Ronda don't really mean all that much to these metrics.
They couldn't mean that much because they couldn't save it. They don't mean more than John Cena. Yeah. It also tells you that for all the talk about, you know, whatever, Becky Lynch's chase and Kofi Kingston's chase, I mean, they got a lot of reaction from a smaller crowd. I mean, and here's the other thing. Like the Raws and SmackDown numbers, you know, for the Monday and Tuesday. I mean, but, you know, SmackDown numbers are never, you know, on Tuesday are never that big. But Raw, in the first 3 months of the year leading to WrestleMania, when you're in the Chicago's and those kind of cities, I mean, those were usually easy sellouts, Chicago's and Boston's, mm-hmm. and all this. And they weren't selling those cities out. And, you know, I remember when they were in Chicago a couple weeks ago, you know, right before Mania. And it's like, well, this is the one, like, you know, yeah, they're not selling out anywhere, but this is the one in Chicago, the Raw before Mania, and All In sold it out, like, in a heartbeat. This is Chicago, it's going to sell out. And when it was like, I think it was like 9,500 or 10,000. I had the number in the Observer, but it was... It shocked me because it's like, what's going on here? So the problem is that, you know, that's the problem. The problem is this product, the stars are not over as stars, and that's the booking. That's not the quality of the people. Because I mean, when I watch it, you know, it's all this stuff of, well, we're promoting the brand. Well, I guess that this is your answer about promoting the brand. Just, you know, that promoting the brand doesn't work.
Yeah,
you, you need stars.
So there's you know, this whole thing about, I think you've said this time and time again, that Vince's idea was, you know, how can we make the product bulletproof so that we're not so reliant on one person or two people?
But you have to have stars or you're going to be at a low level.
Right. So you can do that in certain times, but at some point it's just going to whittle away because outside of John Cena, I mean, there has been Roman Reigns, but he was sort of a level below John Cena. You know, who is there? Like I look at that roster and I go, okay, like just to paraphrase their own terminology, a bunch of B+ players when it comes to star power and who you would really want to market around.
Yet, how many of these guys would you watch in other places? Like, you know, the one that comes to my mind, because I've seen him for so many years, is Ricochet, Matt Riddle, where you look at him and you go, these guys should be superstars, you know, whether it's New Japan or wherever. And I know Ricochet wasn't a superstar in New Japan, but that's also because he would never sign a contract there. And if he stayed there, he was going to be a superstar because he was going to be on the same path as Will Ospreay, who's becoming a superstar there right now. So, but he's on the main roster and, you know, I mean, just the way he's been promoted. I mean, he's just a guy he's thrown on TV. And that doesn't fly. You got to get behind him and you got to put him in with top people. You put him in with middle people and the people accept him as a middle guy. And, you know, it didn't, you know, and whoever, you know, I mean, it's hard because these superstars, it's hard to say what these superstars are. And, you know, you had Daniel Bryan doing these fantastic promos every week. And, you know, as far as, you know, I mean, that wasn't killing it business. I mean, we'd say that too. All those guys that are there. I mean, there were some great, like I said, Becky Lynch was super over in the buildings. Daniel Bryan was a great, great, phenomenal promo. Kofi Kingston's things seemed to resonate with people, but you know, I mean,
you know what this also says to me is Vince doesn't mean anything to TV ratings, or as much because he used money.
Yeah. Vince does, and Stephanie too. Yeah, no, they can't turn it around or anything like that just by being on TV.
And now Shane's on TV every week.
Shane doesn't mean that much. Vince still means a little bit, but you know, not what he used to for sure. And I think he knows it because I don't think he really wants to be on TV, but you know he is. I mean, he's wanted to retire from TV for years.
So this wouldn't explain Q1, but the ratings these past weeks, they promoted, okay, the Raw after WrestleMania, then it was the shakeup, so you have these two big shows. But historically, they've generally told their fans, when WrestleMania ends, you can kind of take a break if you want to take a break, because nothing's really going to happen until SummerSlam or, you know, now Money in the Bank is Money a pretty fun show.
But that's why they rushed into Money in the Bank this year, it was to not have that lull.
Right.
But we're having that lull.
But it's almost like they, you know, the fans sort of feel like, okay, now I can generally take a break around this time of the year.
Yeah.
And it feels like that's part of the reason for the really bad ratings. And they're going to get worse because NBA playoffs, but that happens
every year. But yeah, the ratings will get worse because the NBA playoffs, but there's NBA playoffs every year. Now, the one thing, you know, I mean, which is interesting is the NBA playoffs are down mm-hmm. a lot. But that's the exact same reason wrestling is. Star power.
Mm-hmm. No LeBron,
and the Warriors aren't the draws that they used to be. And the other teams are, you know, what teams are like super big draws right now?
There's teams that the NBA would like to be big draws that are not big draws yet.
Yeah.
Milwaukee Bucks and Giannis and guys like that, where, you know, they're sort of in their infancy, kind of where the Warriors were about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, before they became what they were.
Yeah. But still, you know, like the regular season was I mean, I think ABC and TNT were even. No, ABC and ESPN were even. TNT was down, but it wasn't down that much. I mean, all in all, the season was a little bit down or the same, you know, depending on which station. But the playoffs are way, way down. And that's a measure of, I mean, to me, that's all star power. And I mean, the declines in the NBA, or because LeBron was not in his feature, he wasn't in his favorable time slots by playing on the West Coast all year.
So this is actually an interesting comparison, because today was the NFL draft. ABC, NFL Network, ESPN, they all had broadcasts of this thing.
Right. Well, this is like a big deal.
It's a pretty big deal. But the thing about sports is you have these college farm systems, and these players become stars before they even come into the NBA.
Right. And football, too. Not as much, but...
And the NFL.
Yeah.
But so, you know, for the NBA this year, I'm assuming that they want Zion.
Well, he's the big star, right?
To come into the league on an East Coast team. Mm-hmm. Because then if it's New York Knicks or whatever, then they can put him in those old LeBron slots.
Well, especially, you know, if it's in New York, because you get a superstar in New York and that'll drive the national ratings.
But WWE has the power to do this.
Yeah, they have the advantage over the NBA in the sense that I mean, the one thing they can't control is the injuries. But they absolutely can make stars.
So why can't Matt Riddle be Zion Williamson?
They won't let him be.
Why not, though?
I mean, look, I don't have a good answer. Number one, the reality is that as great as he is and as charismatic as he is when you see him at a live show, and that he got over everywhere he went, is that he's not their kind of a promo. They've taught people that the stars are the ones who go out there and do the long promos. It's not what you do in the ring, it's what you do talking. And who do they have that's a super talker? They got Sami Zayn, who's not Vince's kind of guy, who's a really good talker. Daniel Bryan, who's a great talker. Samoa Joe, who's also not Vince's kind of guy. who's a very good deliverer of lines. He's excellent at it. But, you know, the a lot of the guys are overexposed because they talk so much. But if you don't, the people don't see you as a star. I think that that's one of the things with Ricochet. He hasn't done promos, so the people go, how important could he be? He's not doing promos.
So the line that Vince mentioned about how, you know, guys are hurt and then it hurts the creative, I feel like that was a just a...
Guys are always hurt.
Shouldn't the creative raise the game when stuff like that happens? You can create a new star.
That's what happened to Kofi.
And that's behind somebody else.
They wanted to do with Mustafa Ali. They wanted to recreate Kevin Owens as this, like, guy next door babyface. I mean, they had ideas, but none of them clicked, partially because I think that the whole idea, everything about it, it's, you know, I mean, again, all of this stuff that we're talking about, you know, the thing is that when you get over the age of 35, while there are declines, they're not terrible. The declines are under the age of 35, which also leads to the difference in the merch. But that's also the scary thing because that's your future. Mm-hmm. This is not a popular product, you know, even though you go to the arenas and you'll see a lot. But then, I mean, it's one of those things where someone may go to me and go like, I see more kids in the crowd than I saw 20 years ago. And I say, when there's 4,000 people in the crowd versus 12,000, the kids may be more prominent, mm-hmm. but there's not more of them.
Right.
There's, you know, the reality is that, you know, that aspect is way, way down. And ratings wise, I mean, when you look at last year's ratings and this year's ratings, it's the under 35 where you really see the difference. You know, the over 50 is down, but in, you know, it's down normal, but that under 35 is way down. And that's the thing that worries me, because it's like, if you're not creating those new fans, you know, 10, 15 years from now, you're not going to have those fans that are like us that grew up with this thing. Because, you know, it's like my son's friends, you know, I mean, when I was his age, you know, when I was his age, there were a lot of fans. When actually a few years younger, every kid was a fan. I think at 16, it wasn't as much. At 12, 13, everybody was. But when he was 12, 13, none of his classmates were. And now he's 16 and they have some have a knowledge and most don't even care and have no knowledge. It's completely different.
Who's the person? So, you know, when I'm growing up, everyone in my class knows who Hogan is.
Everyone.
But everyone
in his class knows who John Cena is.
Okay.
He would tell me John, you know, everyone knows John Cena.
So that's the guy.
Yeah.
In today's, you know, cause,
but John Cena's not Hulk Hogan.
But he's also not there anymore.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, a lot of this may speak to the fact that there's John Cena and they can't replace John Cena, just like they couldn't replace Hulk Hogan. Although they survived, you know, the Bret Hart and everything and Shawn and all those people. But, I mean, it went way down until, you know, Steve Austin took it back.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Dwayne. But, you know, I mean, and John's not even as big as they were. But I guess John's about as, you know, again, like with the merchandise down. I mean, who was the biggest merchandise seller for years and years was John. So, you know, that hurt. That's probably hurting a lot. But, you know, the lack of interesting storylines is the key. The lack of, you know, the stop and start. So here's another thing. You know, the one thing, you know, people go, oh, they don't listen to the fans. Well, the fact is this last quarter, they did listen to the fans and everything went to hell. Now they didn't do good storylines listening to the fans, but they did listen. I mean, they made Kofi and Becky Lynch the stars. They built everything to put them over at Mania. Then they put them over at Mania. And then the shows after they put them over, you know, just tanked in the ratings. So, you know, before Vince's thing was, and I just remember like when I was, you know, learning the business and Paul Bosch was like, you can't listen to the fans because if you listen and do exactly what they want, you're not going to make any money. You've got to lead the fans to what you want to, you got to tell them. So you know, they're not going to be able to tell you good stories. They're just going to cheer for who they want to. You've got to lead them with good stories. I mean, it was like, if you listen to the fans and just put over who they want all the time, you're not going to, you know, I tried that. It doesn't work. So, I mean, that's an interesting lesson because Vince is, you know, for years did that mentality. And
you know, I know what they want more than they even know what they want.
Yeah, and he would say it in the air, and he meant it, you know. And that's why he would ignore Daniel Bryan, you know, or not, you know, try to keep those guys down. But, you know, he got to this point where he's hearing it so much. So, you know, and things weren't going good that way either, you know. I mean.
What's the answer?
The answer is a scary one. I mean, the answer is we got to wait until, you know, someone shows up and is the guy.
They got this pool of talent at NXT, and the NXT program is so good. And yet, when it's time for those guys to come up and those women, they flounder, or they don't mean as much as they mean on NXT.
Yeah, maybe they almost never do. You know, yeah. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, the answer is to take one of these guys and really go with them. And I mean, they are, but the guy's Lars.
So would you consider...
And Lacey Evans, those are the ones they've chosen.
If you ultimately have to give them a pass or fail on Ronda, is it a pass or fail?
Well, she did elevate the whole women's division. I mean,
she was fantastic. As a performer,
she was way, way, way better than anyone had any right to expect. And she was so much better. They lucked into something with her passion for wrestling and just her natural athletic ability and her ability to be intense. You know, like she picked, there's aspects of wrestling that she did better than people who've been doing it for 20 years. You know, as far as like being able to be into the character and believing in her character and being real, which did turn people off when they, you know, heard those weird promos and all. But that was, you know, that was close to being real. And her matches gave you that real vibe because she had that unique intensity. So in that sense, but.
Bottom line, what is it? What did she actually mean to the bottom line?
She got the women over. To a degree, but the women being featured, but like it's the same thing with that Evolution pay-per-view. I mean, everybody talked about it. It was a wonderful show,
yep.
You know, and all that. But I remember like the Google Trends, because we don't get pay-per-view numbers, but the two things that we do get, because we know that they did sell out, but it's also the New York market, but it was a struggle to sell out. It wasn't like a sellout like most of the shows in New York when it's a big show. It did not sell tickets at the rate maybe that they would have hoped for.
Yep.
But they did sell out in the end, so that's okay. But when I saw the Google Trends after, it's like, okay, this show probably would not have done a big pay-per-view number. In fact, it would have done a terrible pay-per-view number. And that is the thing. Maybe one of the, you know, maybe women at that in that main event slot, as much as we want it to happen and everything like that, maybe for the masses, it's not quite there. I mean, I remember when they 35 years ago when they tried it with Wendy Richter and it flopped miserably. And I remember like all the old timers, it's like, this isn't going to work. And it didn't. And they gave up on it real quick. But yeah, I mean, look, a lot of people when they decided to like start putting the women on top, there were the questions. But the reaction felt like they were the biggest. I mean, Becky Lynch felt like she was the biggest star. And she, it's look, you can't blame Becky Lynch in the sense of she was more over than everyone else. And, but she was, you know, did she bring in the fringe fans back? Did she bring fans back? No, she didn't. Ronda Rousey didn't either.
And I don't think the solution is to go, oh, you know, the women can't be in the main event anymore. I think part of the solution is, we need to continue to do this until we figure out, because if you limit your people in the main event to just male wrestlers, and you've been really pushing lately.
Look, Ronda Rousey proved that done correctly, women in the main event can work. Okay. And she was successful to a degree, but not as successful as guys before. But some of that could be the booking.
I almost feel like they did not exactly know what to do with her.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. We don't know if Ronda Rousey is Bill Goldberg. You know what I mean? Because what people want, whether it's, you know, Curry or LeBron or whatever, they want dominant stars. They don't want 50-50s. If every team in the NBA was 50-50, you know, it's like you think that, like, or the NFL, and you think, oh, the best thing is parity. Anyone could win on any day. Those are boring seasons. People want to see 17-0 teams. You almost never get them.
You want the fan bases to think that there can be parity in the NFL, but the dominant teams are the draws.
The dominant teams are draws. The Warriors, when they were going for the record, that's when they were at their peak of their drawing power. You want those. That's what you want. When you don't have that, things are going to go down. And you don't have that superhero because they won't book that superhero. They're in control. That's the thing. They're in control. Now, granted, they didn't beat Ronda, you know, until WrestleMania. So it wasn't like that they, you know, ruined her. But, and you know, I mean, you and I have talked about it many times. One of Ronda's curses was that they found out that she can sell really well.
And this goes back about a year when you and Brian were having this conversation, and you said that...
I said that,
yeah,
from the very beginning.
You said that you weren't sure if that was the best thing for her, was that she could actually sell, because they were going to make her sell.
Right. Well, I had heard from people in the company, it's like, you won't believe how good... This is before she had her first match. You won't believe how good Ronda can sell. And I was scared, because it's like, now you're going to think that we can have her sell a lot and do these long matches, and that's probably not what's going to get her over, because she needs to be Superwoman and be the one that everyone gravitates towards, as opposed to we're gonna make her sell a lot for Stephanie. I mean, it was a wonderful match, but and actually even though she did sell for Stephanie and a lot of people, I when I saw that match, I thought this is like all a positive. But in time, you know, I mean, in part, partially the problem is that she did too much television.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think maybe that's the thing with a lot of them, but they're so concerned about the ratings. So it's, you know, I think that it's a tough situation. It really is. But it's like, I don't think that the women are the problem as much as that nobody has, you know, and it really only takes one guy, but they don't have that guy, you know, or girl, you know, or woman. I mean, like, perhaps Ronda could have been it, perhaps not, but the way she was used, she wasn't special. She was on TV every week, so in time that took her down to the level of everyone else.
Last question for me, but we need to talk about Luke Harper before we get to the interviews. If Conor McGregor walked into NXT and he was right there and they knew, like, okay, this guy could be the big thing, would they know what to do with him? Like, would they be able to push him as the next big thing, or would they make him, or would they homogenize him and kind of make him, you know, just like everyone else?
Probably make him like everyone else.
Isn't that part of the problem?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's like Paul Levesque has said this on many times. It's like, we have to teach them our playbook, you know? And it's like, that's the mentality. And maybe it's like, well, you know, we're not even sure that this is the right playbook, but this is our playbook, and you got to learn our playbook. This is how we do things. But maybe they need more freedom. They do need more freedom. It's not maybe. It's the same thing that's been said. It's a weird thing because it is said over and over again. But if Steve Austin, Superstar Billy Graham, Ric Flair, any of these guys came along right now in this system, Ray Stevens, you know, I can go on and on and on. They're not getting out of it because they're never going to be able to do those promos that got them over. But none of them. Dusty too.
Is it somewhat a mentality, though? Because you hear Austin tell stories about how much of an individual he was and how he liked to do stuff by himself and how he wasn't going to, like, sort of take no for an answer in that way. Like, do they have guys on the roster who have that mentality? Because it seems like...
Jericho did.
He did, and he's not there anymore.
Yeah, he thought he could have more fun being somewhere else and ended up having more fun, and turned out he was right.
But Is that mentality getting beaten out of the wrestlers? Because I can't imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they have the system that they do.
Look at what Omega said when he was, you know, and he considered going there strongly, you know. And if there was no AEW, I think Kenny Omega would be in WWE right now. Maybe not, because they probably wouldn't have given him as big an offer.
He said he'd have to turn his brain off, though.
Well, that's where I was getting. It's like the idea is, okay, I can go here and turn my brain off. Well, turn your brain off and you're going to get a good guy in the ring, but you're not going to get the promos that he was doing. Mm. You're not going to get that thoughtfulness and that uniqueness. You're not going to get the uniqueness. And that's where it all falls. I mean, I watch those promos and they're not all terrible. I like some of them, you know, but so often, you know, I will just hear a promo and it's just a disconnect for me. You know, it's like, I've been 4-time Intercontinental Champion and I've been 2-time WWE Champion and I was a Money in the Bank winner. And it's like, fuck, I don't want to hear that in a promo. I mean, I don't mind hearing it once, but I don't want to hear it in like 3 promos every week.
But it goes back to when I was a kid, I could name all the Intercontinental Champions up to a certain point. And today, I don't even know who's Intercontinental Champion now. And I watch the program every week.
Yeah, I know I'd have to sit for a second, but I mean, I know who it is, but yeah.
Okay, so we have a few more minutes to talk about Luke Harper. What's going on with Luke?
Luke Harper, obviously everyone knows he asked for his release. He was as nice as he could be publicly in doing so, and he was turned down. He's been told that not only is he not released, but that his contract is being extended. So, you know, the gist is that, you know, he was coming back and he was going to be in a program with Sami Zayn, and for whatever reason, you know, they canceled it. And he just felt, you know, if they don't have anything, especially he does the match with Dijakovic, which is a hell of a match. And, you know, I think that you're at a certain age and it's like, this is my time. I got to make my move. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to get old, you know, and he's older. He's 39. I'll be 40 in a year type of thing. You know, I've kind of been in a holding pattern for a couple of years. I mean, the Bludgeon Brothers thing would have been all right, but they got hurt right away and it kind of didn't go anywhere. I think that, you know, he thought that, you know, coming back in the Battle Royal, you know, he could be featured, but whatever. You know, it's time to make the move. They're not, you know, I think he was convinced, and rightly so, that, you know, because I've heard from people who know what's going on, that they, you know, one person who knows what's going on there, you know, knows everything that's going on there, just said, you know, I mean, you know, for a lot of people, just go, they're paranoid, blah, 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 blah. When it was Luke Harper, it was like, yeah, the best thing for Luke Harper is to leave. But he's in a holding pattern for a long, long time. They froze his contract over those 6 months he was out with the wrist surgery. So it's a bad, his thing's a bad deal. You know, it's like, this is often a cruel business. And in his case, he's getting a bad, you know.
But his strategy of the way that he wanted to do it really just backfired on him.
It backfired on him. They treat everyone different. I think that because it worked, so here's the deal, because it worked with Dillinger and because it worked with Dustin Runnels, I think that the feeling was, if it works with him, then they're going to get flooded with people.
Or maybe they just find him to be a little bit more valuable.
100, well, that's what it is. Well, that's the reason.
Yeah.
If they thought he was going to go somewhere else and not be valuable at all, they'd let him go.
Yep.
I think that with Dustin, I think they knew that at that age there was, you know, and maybe Dustin will go and prove them wrong anyway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they probably thought there's limited value because Vince hasn't pushed Dustin in years because of the age. It's not that he can't work.
Even though you can't actually tell how old he is underneath face paint.
True. And he's in good shape. He's in better shape than he was when he was Gold Dust in his, you know, I mean, and everything in a lot of ways. But yeah, you know, and it was a comedy gimmick anyway. And it, you know, it, in Vince's eyes, it had run its course, and it had, really. So, but whatever, you know, they with Harper, you don't want to be the company where, you know, people will go and look and just go, hey, we had this guy and we cut him, and now he's in this other company and he's like a big star, you know, kind of the EC3 thing, you know. And they got back at EC3, they proved that he really wasn't a big star, but that's negative too.
Yeah,
you know, but that's, I guess that's the deal. But yeah, for Luke Harper, it's screwed. There's no other way to put it. It's really screwed.
Okay, so we're going to throw to the John Fitch interview that first, then Elimelech will be after that. If it sounds a little bit like the Fitch interview is joined in progress, like an old primetime wrestling match, it's because I missed your actual introduction. I didn't miss it, but the audio didn't come in clearly. So it's like your second question. We lead off with your second question. But and then we'll be back after the interviews to quickly wrap things up. Here's John Fitch.
Yeah, and you know, in that period too. I mean, I actually just saw this in the last week or two. So you had a fight in Mexico, and so you actually had a fight, a win that has never been credited to you until like the last couple of weeks.
It was a good 10-second knockout, 10-second TKO.
Yeah, yeah. So
because it was the Mexican promoter when he said my name with the lisp, it was John Fish.
Yeah.
So they reported it, and there's one guy on Sure Dog
with a 1-0 record.
1-0 record, and his name was John Fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you finally cleared that up after all these years.
All these years, I kept telling people my record, but like nobody was really paying attention. It's good to have. And then for a long time, like I had those two amateur fights were counted as professional fights because they came after my first professional fight.
Oh, okay.
So it's also, you know, it's kind of backwards because I fought one fight, I lost to Mike, I lost my very first fight. Don't like his last name, Mike. It was one of Monty Cox's events, Extreme Cage, whatever. Ebersol called and said, "Yeah, well, he's had one fight and he lost, but then he let me do the tournament anyways. I mean, I had to pay to fight."
Yeah.
But I won money at the casino afterwards. So. I won like $200 at the casino afterwards. So I got my money for I got my money back for paying to fight in the tournament.
Oh, geez, yeah. So I mean, now. All the wars and everything that you've been through, you know, been through a lot of years, a lot of training. You went through that, we talked earlier, I remember watching the way you guys trained in that full contact, full sparring, what was it, 3 days a week period?
Yep.
You know, it's like, you've learned a lot.
Learned a ton. I mean, yeah, we'd do our stand-up sparring hard, 3 rounds, and then we do our ground rounds, and we'd have our small gloves, and we'd be hitting each other pretty good on the ground too. So like,
yeah,
we did a lot of beating each other up a lot.
Now, when did you kind of figure out that you've got to give your body time to recover? Was it a gradual thing, or did you kind of just
it was a gradual thing. You know, things just started changing a little bit. Part of it too was, you know, getting the experience of actual fighting. I think when you're younger and you haven't had that much competition, you haven't fought much, you got to spar a little bit more. You got to do a little more hard grappling. Because you have to develop, you know, that kinesthetic awareness. You have to get your body used to doing those things. But after you've been doing it for a while, like, you don't need to go as hard anymore. You need to be in shape, and you need to be strong, and you need to be flexible and stretch out and make sure everything's healing well and recovering well. But the primary objective for you is to learn the technique and develop your game plan and your own personal game, your own personal strategies. And that's more developed through drills and chain drills, especially, you know, takedown to the guard pass to the submission, you know, type of stuff, rather than just, you know, hitting a heavy bag or sparring hard or just hitting mitts. Because that was a big part of it, I think, back in the day was heavy bag, hitting mitts, and sparring hard.
So now also you went through diet. You went from, I'm not sure what you were doing first, but I remember you and I had talked years ago when you got into the vegan phase, and you had mentioned, you know, it was good at first, and then you've gotten out of it for, you can kind of explain what happened through that phase of dieting.
I mean, I didn't have a terrible diet before, but I had a lot more processed food, I was eating a lot more sugar, a lot more, you know, just unhealthy stuff, sugary drinks. I drink a lot of like Kool-Aid, stuff like that. So when I went vegan, I quit all the processed stuff and started eating whole foods. And that was a big change. All the positive benefits I got were from that. But after a while, those positive benefits wore off because I wasn't getting the protein and the meat I needed. The amount of effort it took to prepare and eat the vegan food all day long, like one, you're eating fresh veggies and stuff, non-processed stuff. So like you have to go to the store like twice a week just to keep getting stuff and not having it. You can't have it lay around for a week because it rots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was just too much work to maintain a certain level, and you still were, I was too small, started getting hurt, started getting injured. You know, when I had the BJ Penn fight, like at most of that camp, I was like 182, 183 pounds. Normally I'm 187, 190. So I could tell that that wasn't working for me. I started eating meat on the weekends then, which I called like a weekday vegan thing. And then that only lasted until about, you know, I think before the Eric Silva fight. Then I started eating more regular meat, but I was eating whole foods and I was cutting the sugar out more. And that worked well for me. And I also started, that was 2013, I started lifting weights. And that was a big, big help for me, starting to lift like a martial artist and not a bodybuilder. So with that,
So is that like more reps lighter weight, or is it just different?
No, I just need to maintain a certain level of strength. I'm not going to failure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So a lot of bodybuilding stuff is going to failure, even with football type of lifts. I don't need to be that powerful. You know, I can't, if I go to failure, like you need like a day to recover from going to failure. So like, it's not about that. It's like, if I need a decent amount of weight that I can hit my reps, hit them explosively. And then I break up the workouts. So like, I'm only doing like 1 to 4 lifts a day. It's not going to take me any more than 30, 35 minutes to get through the session. So like, it can stack with the other workouts I have throughout the day, and it's not a problem. Whereas if you're doing like 8 to 10 lifts and you're doing like to failure, like you're not going to be able to go to jiu-jitsu and boxing later in the day and then finish off with cardio. Like, it's just too much. Your body doesn't have enough time to recover. So I have a thing I say, it's like, you have to treat lifting weights like hygiene, like brushing your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to like skip brushing your teeth for a few weeks and then brush the crap out of them, you know, for like an hour. It doesn't really help you. Do a little bit every day to keep them healthy. So I think the lifting made a big difference. It kept me strong longer. And this would be, you know, I'll fight Saturday night. I'll do a lift on Monday, you know. But then, yeah, and then in 2016, I started like the bodybuilder style of dieting. So I'd eat 6 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them are shakes, a lot more meat, eggs. And then in the last year or so, I've started eating more fat and reducing the carbs. And it just keeps getting better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this stage of your life, you're scheduled to fight Saturday night. And in theory, if you win, you come back June 14th in Madison Square Garden, which is a real quick turnaround, and they're both 5-round fights.
Mm-hmm.
And this tournament's also, you know, money-wise, it can be I don't say life-changing, but...
Not life-changing, but
it's significant.
It can significantly create some chances to take advantage of some opportunities.
Yeah.
Right? There's some things that I could get off the ground and start working on, and those projects could become life-changing.
Yeah.
So, definitely. But it's great. I mean, I'm not getting any younger. So, like, why wait? Why wait another year before the next fight?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, I want to defend the belt at 42. Nah.
Yeah.
Let's knock him out. Let's get him out of the way this year. You know, so I'm okay with the quick turnaround. You know, it'll definitely be different training. I'll have to come back and do a little bit of cardio next week. You know, there's not really any off time. And then... They're talking already about possible the finals in September.
Really? That's awful quick too.
Yeah. So I mean, let's knock them out. I mean,
you have to not get hurt now.
I've fought 3 times where I had more than 1 fight in a night.
That's true. Yeah.
So like, I'm like, you know, let's do 3 fights in the night. Let's just do them one night, and as long as I get paid for each fight, right? Let's do that.
Yeah.
I'll take that, because then it's 1 training camp.
Yeah.
You know, now at this point in my career, I'm like, yeah, you know, that tournament sounds kind of nice. Let's do it all one night. as long as I get paid each fight. My show on win purse each fight, that sounds good.
So now you mentioned to me that you've written a book and you're thinking about writing other books. So tell us a little about the book stuff.
Well, I started a journal in 2000. I had a wrestling coach who said this will help you with being I don't blank on the word. Holding yourself accountable. That's it. Accountable. Mm-hmm. Holding yourself accountable. So you write your workouts, stuff like that in the book, and you can go back and make sure you did them. And it really helped. I put it away after the summer that I used it, but then I found it again before I left for California. I had already started fighting. I had some bumps in the road. There wasn't really much training in Indiana at all. And I had already made up my mind to go and train in California. So I found the book again. I was like, you know what? I'm gonna start writing this thing again. So I kept a pretty strict journal for about 17 years or so. And I was like, you know, I might as well just share these. I was going to write like an autobiography. But as I started going through the passages in the journal, I was like, I can't encompass all of this, you know, in a free form type of autobiography. So I just said, screw it. I'm just sharing the journal itself because there's no better way for people to get a sense of kind of the obsession and the madness and the craziness of what was going on. So like people are going to get to see what I was thinking, what I was going through as things happened. And then I write reflections, you know, intros and outros, reflections over what was going on, what I feel about how I was thinking and feeling then, kind of making points about how this was really bad thinking. This is not healthy thought, or how it was a good thing, and you know, some of the discipline and some of the things that I did back then, and it kind of actually, that's why I'm having fun again. It's just like the passion and the fun. Like I was having the greatest time. I was living off $800 a month, mm-hmm. barely scraping together out here in California, but I was having a blast. Like I loved every minute of it. So it kind of brought me back to that point in my life and my youth a little bit, and it was really therapeutic doing that. But I have a bunch more books. That was my first journal. Three more, and then like the third journal is the thick book, so like it might be broken into two or three books itself.
Now you mentioned that, you know, you went through a couple of years back, you know, pretty were, so you're in UFC top 10, I don't remember the number was. What number were you when they cut you? Because that was like
I can't even remember. It was around 2012 or 13, yeah, something like that. I think it was around 2013. Because I fought Eric Silva, I think 2013, and then Maia, and that was it.
Yeah.
But it kind of started, like, looking back over stuff, like, it kind of started around the BJ Penn fight, mm-hmm. right? Because I was supposed to get a title shot after fighting Thiago Alves.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Right? But they pulled that at the press conference right after the fight, and I thought it was a great performance. I was really happy with how I did.
Well, you dominated him, and he was a top guy, yeah.
And he was in shape, ready to go, and he fought hard. It wasn't like, you know, there was something wrong with it. I just really performed well, and you know, Joe Silva was saying stuff under his breath to insult me, and
really,
and then they took the title shot away, and then I was just like, what's going on? Like they started turning the sport into entertainment rather than winning or losing. Like that was really when they started pushing the, well, it doesn't matter if you win, it's whether or not you're entertaining or not. And that just kind of really, there's a disconnect for me as an athlete. As
well, coming from the wrestling background.
Yeah, from like where meritocracy is it, it's life.
Yeah.
So that kind of started it. And then I got married too, and there were some issues going on with the marriage and kids and stress, and then money became a problem when I got cut with the UFC. That became a big problem because we bought a second house and mm-hmm. trying to remodel, and it's just an added stress. So I had all this stress and all this pressure and all this stuff going on all at once, and I don't think I dealt with it very well at all. And that's another reason I'm going through these journals, because I kind of want to see the steps leading up to those points and see if I can kind of break down exactly what happened. And maybe if there's somebody else out there who's going through similar things, they can learn from that and avoid the same situation I was in. But I think a big part of it was I put so much into the idea that, you know, my future self was UFC champion and all these opportunities would stem after that. And once I got cut from the UFC, then, well, that wasn't a possibility anymore. And that meant all the other things, all the other opportunities were gone too. So, like, I think I lost my, my mission, my life's mission. Like, what was I doing? Why was I doing this? Am I just fighting to fight? Like, I'm not even making that much money anymore. So just kind of downward spiral, And the thing that kind of saved me was, you know, I think, I don't know if it was pride or what, but like focusing on just training hard. Like no matter what, I still showed up to train. I still showed up to the gym. I still busted my ass. Because it was like the one thing in all this crazy madness that I could still control. It's like I could still control my workouts. I could still control what I'm doing in the gym.
So now you went for a period, you tried steroids, which when you were younger was probably something that was you would never do because you had the exact opposite mentality.
Exactly.
And you actually told an interesting story. I actually told Garrett this just a few minutes ago about how when you were in UFC and you were beating everyone, your mentality was kind of like, well, how effective could this be?
Because I didn't think they were.
I'm beating guys on it regularly. Yeah.
And then after doing it, like that's still my mentality. I don't think it helps that much.
Yeah.
Especially like, I mean, I'm not involved. Not knowledgeable enough about all of it.
But then like, we see Vitor.
Because there's people getting covered up and people on legal TRT. And I was like, man, all these guys are making tons of money. Like I took like a 70%, you know, pay. I was making less money to win than I was losing when I was getting paid to lose in the UFC. It's like, I was getting like 30-30 with the World Series.
That's a big drop.
And then I was making like 64-64 or like whatever in the UFC. So like I was making less money winning in you know the other organization than losing in the UFC. So that was a big indicator too. I was like, why am you know this is a business. I'm supposed to treat this like a business. Well, a businessman would do what he needs to do to make the money. And then after going through the experience, like I can only speak of testosterone because that's what I tried. I don't think testosterone is athletic performance enhancing. I think it builds muscle. So unless you're trying to move up a weight class, I'm not seeing where the real benefits are because I didn't feel like I recovered any faster.
Really?
I couldn't grapple because the injection sites were so sore. Like I couldn't sit on my ass. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. Like it was awful. It was an awful experience. I hate needles, and it would take me like a half hour to get the needle in my ass because I couldn't just jam it in. I was too scared. So I'd like push it slowly and twist it, mm-hmm. and it would take forever. And sometimes I would get nervous, and I'd be sweating. So then the sweat would get on the needle, and I would get panicked and like wipe with alcohol, and I'd throw it all away because I thought I'd get a serious infection or something if my sweat got into my body. So like I ended up fighting Polaris, and I didn't really do any.
Who undoubtedly, work. You know, Polaris, like in your mind,
when
you look at him and go like,
cheating, and if he gets something, he's gonna hold on. And
he's gonna hurt you, so I got to make sure not to get hurt.
So so many bullshit excuses, none of them are legit. But like, it was all this shit's going through my head, just trying to make an excuse why it was okay, and then. You know, just the experience. I don't think it was very beneficial at all. And I looked great. I could eat kind of whatever I wanted to and look great. And that was about, like the only thing. And then I had the libido of like a 19-year-old. You know, which I think that might have led to the divorce too. But like, yeah. So like, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of other type of drugs out there that guys are using. But like, I didn't. My personal experience was it wasn't good. And it could have been like I wasn't using enough. Because I had read online that there was way, because you get away with like what 3-to-1 ratios.
Well, you can do. I guess 4-to-1 is the cutoff.
4-to-1 is like
So 3-to-1 you can get away with.
So like you could do low levels of according to what I'd read. You could do low levels of it, and still be fine because you could be 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 and like you're still under so that you still pass, and so maybe I wasn't using enough to feel the benefits, and then I would self test. But like I don't know if my self-test thing would work because it was like a mail-in self-test. So.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was like going to a lab and whatever. So, I was ejecting up until the Sunday before the fight. Because I thought that, that was okay because if your levels are a certain level, you'd be fine. But like my levels were like 9-to-1 or whatever. Like it was like 9-to-1. They're like, yeah, so we sent it in to get a test for a synthetic. So like I think that's one of the things the guys need to, it needs to be a synthetic test every time. But it's a little bit more expensive, so they don't do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was chaos. It was comedy. It was comedy. Me trying to figure out how to freaking use steroids. So stupid.
So now, when we look at you know, you were involved in this lawsuit with Kung Lee, right?
The class action lawsuit. Yep.
So now where does that stand? And
right
all
now
that?
We are, there is going to be evidentiary hearings in August.
Let me make rules. It's against UFC, yep. Just so people know. You and Kung Lee.
It's an antitrust.
Who else is involved? Because there's a lot of names, but then there's not as many names now, right?
There are named plaintiffs. It's a class action antitrust lawsuit. So we're saying they're breaking federal law. They've created a monopoly. They've created it on purpose. And we're trying to prove that, and that's illegal. We're representing every fighter who's fought from 2010 to present day. So every fighter, if there's a settlement, you know, the judge will decide how the funds are split up, but everybody is being represented. Unless you signed off saying, I don't want to be a part of this because I intend to sue on my own, or you don't believe in it. So nobody's done that.
Yeah.
So, like, all the fighters are kind of in on it.
Okay, that's interesting.
Right. So if fighters didn't think what we were doing was worthwhile, they could have signed off and said, "Oh, I don't want any of the settlement. I don't think this is legit." Mm-hmm. Nobody did that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone through all the discovery, and that's taken a long process. And there's been things filed back and forth, and it keeps getting stalled. Now they are doing an evidentiary hearing, so they're going to take the experts from both sides, the economic experts from both sides. The judge is going to listen to both sides and kind of decide on which side is honest and which side sounds like they're bullshitting. And they're also, I think, calling in Joe Silva as a part of it also.
Mm-hmm. I know he's testified. I've seen the name.
Oh, yeah, there's been a bunch of guys who've done their testimony.
No, Dana did too, because I saw his name. Yeah,
I think the Fertittas might have also. I did. There's some quite juicy emails that we're hoping will eventually get out.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, okay. So, I guess we were told to kind of wrap it up. So, so you're going to be fighting Saturday against Rory. Saturday. Real quick. I mean, what's your thoughts on Rory? You know, Rory's a top level guy, probably the best guy you fought in a while.
Yeah, really tough guy. I'm happy to fight. You know, I'm just really happy to be here. Really happy to fight for another title, another organization. I rise to the top of everywhere I go. It's going to be fun. He's a tough guy. He's durable. It could be a really blood guts type of fight, and you know, I'm ready for it.
Okay, and then you're going to be turning around right away as long as you don't get hurt in the fight.
Yep, as long as nothing's broken, we're going to be, you know, back into training camp Monday.
Yeah, and then...
We're doing cardio and hitting the squat rack on Monday.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, right. Very great. Very good talking to you.
Yeah, man.
We're here with Alima Leigh McFarland, who's fighting Vita Arteaga on Saturday night in San Jose at the SAP Center in Flyweight Championship Defense. And we've met before, and mm-hmm. we've done a show before together. Mm-hmm. And I do want to tell you this because, and I've written this like probably 20 times and said it on the air. So the beginning of the walkout in Hawaii mm-hmm. was probably one of the five best moments I've ever had as a fan watching MMA since the beginning, for 26 years. It was an amazing spectacle. It was emotional. It was everything. Mm-hmm. I could see you kind of crying and everything. Mm-hmm. And I know you set that up and you worked real hard on it. And yeah. What's kind of like, that was one of the most amazing moments in history of sport, I think.
Thank you. And that really means a lot coming from you. Like you said, you've been here since the beginning. You've seen probably thousands and thousands of walkouts and shows. So that's honestly really...
I would say it's one of the three best.
Thank you. But you know, it was definitely a collective effort. And I say collective because I did have this vision. I did want to be escorted out by Kahili bearers, which traditionally they would be escorting out the royalty, Hawaiian royalty. And so I had that vision. I contacted the men that I wanted to walk me out. I actually offered to, I had asked like Max and BJ if they would want to, but they're like, oh, we don't want to wear malos, which is the, you know, like loincloth, the traditional loincloth. So, but it was fine. My Kahili bearers, they were the ones that had the idea, okay, we're going to start with the chant. We're going to do this. We're going to have the Hawaiian flags. But then also the reason why I was so successful is because Bellator was on board with it. The production side of everything, they were completely on board and they worked hand in hand with us the entire way. And even down to the commentators, they were like, okay, explain what you're doing right here. What is this? Okay, this is the exchange of breath, the ha. So again, it was a definitely collective effort. And then when it actually happened, then the audience was also a huge part of it. Because I'm not sure if you noticed, but in the beginning, the chant that they were doing, Ikul Mau Mau, it was a responsive chant. So the audience was responding to the Kahili bearers. And so that just made it like, oh my gosh, everybody played a role in it. And I think that's what made it so powerful.
How was fighting after that? Because it's like an emotional experience. Then you got to go into a serious fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, I was trying to keep it together because I was crying backstage in the locker room. I was already crying. And then I was crying backstage right in the staging area while the Kahili bearers were out on stage. So I was like, okay, I got it together. I'm good. I got all the tears out. And then as soon as I started walking out, I made eye contact with my brother in the audience. And it just came back, you know, everything, all the emotions came flooding back. So, yeah, a lot of people were kind of concerned, like, how is she about to fight right now? But, you know, as soon as I stepped in, and I think this comes with hours and hours of visualization. As soon as I stepped inside the cage, it just clicked, you know, it switched back on. So, I think it just comes with practice. And now that I know that I'm able to do that under those circumstances, I can do anything.
So what's the difference? I mean, fighting in Hawaii, it was the first major MMA show in Hawaii in years and years, the first mm-hmm. for UFC or Bellator. And you're the focal point of all the promotion, the main event, and defending your championship. Mm-hmm. And now you're coming to San Jose where it's basically now you're here to fight.
Yes.
As opposed to being the whole show and the whole promotion and you know, the sellout crowd or the local crowd and everything like that. So what's the difference between this fight and going into that fight? Do you feel different pressure or less pressure?
I feel so much less pressure here being in San Jose. And, you know, of course, Bellator Hawaii was the most incredible week of my life. I loved it, but I can't do that every single time I fight. Like, no way. So I just don't have the emotional capacity for that, you know? So I welcomed fighting in San Jose. And, you know, San Jose is not even that far from Hawaii. It's just a plane ride away, even from San Diego, where I currently live and train. Super easy. I have a lot of people coming. I have cousins. Hawaiians are everywhere. So I have tons of cousins up here, tons of relatives. So it is a very nice change of pace, though. I do feel less pressure, but it offers like a new type of excitement. So I'm totally not like coming down from Bellator Hawaii at all. Like, I'm still super excited for this fight. It's just a different atmosphere and a whole new different experience.
Now, when the fight in Hawaii was over and everything was over, I mean, did you look back? Did you have a down period or did you have a period of like just exaltation? Like, everything went so perfect. It's almost ridiculous.
It seriously took weeks to like finally recover from everything, because I stayed another week in Hawaii thinking that was going to be my downtime. Definitely had zero downtime. It was still boom, 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 on to the next, you know? So it was, I probably had maybe half an hour to myself in my hotel room after the fight, before I had to go to the after party. And just that little moment, I was just like on my bed, just, I can't believe that really happened, you know?
It's almost like the whole thing was a dream.
It really was. And it was kind of a blur, but I'm just like, all right. So I kind of had to relive everything, you know, through social media, look at all the posts, rewatch stuff. But yeah, it's just, it still feels like a dream. It really took me a long time to recover. I think I didn't recover until like, I went to Cuba, and that was because they don't have internet there. So it was just me by myself, lots of books, you know? So I was like, okay, that was my time to like relax.
So what's your thoughts on Vita?
Vita's a badass. Mm-hmm. I think she is like a caged animal, you know? And so I think she definitely deserved this title shot. Every single one of her fights has been a barn burner. She brings it every time. Even the two fights that she's lost were really controversial. Everybody thought that she had won those. So I'm expecting her to come out like she always does, guns blazing. And I'm thinking it's going to be a really exciting fight. Like, some days I think I'm going to run through her, and other days I'm like, oh fuck, I'm going to get knocked out, you know? So I don't know. It's just, I flip back and forth. But I do that with a lot of my opponents. But Vita, man, like, she really is. I respect her so much as a fighter she is, just always down.
What's, I mean, as far as like entrance goes, video and all that. I mean, do you have any idea of what's going to be happening in San Jose Saturday, that part of your thing?
Oh yeah, I always have that stuff. I have that stuff planned before I even like know who my opponent is.
so is going to be cool videos and things like that?
Yeah, for sure. So the theme for this fight, and I theme every fight. So like my Pechanga fight was red for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Movement. I had just started a scholarship for young Native girls. So I just really wanted to bring awareness to that movement. So red is the color for that. So that was that theme. My theme for Bellator Hawaii was yellow and Oahu, because that's every island has their own color, theme song, nickname. So Oahu, the island that I'm from, and the island that Bellator Hawaii was on, their color's yellow. So everything was yellow. You know, even my fight shirts had yellow ilima le. Also, ilima is the flower of Oahu. So that was the whole theme. So for this theme, I keep bumping the table. Oh, gosh. Okay. So for this fight, we actually decided to go with water and the Hawaiian wave. And this actually started the week before Bellator Hawaii. Max Holloway fought Brian Ortega up in Canada. And he was interviewed when he got back home. And he said, you know, the Hawaiian wave has started, because he fought first and then it was me. And then the week after that was BJ. And there was other Hawaiian fighters in that mix too, like Brad Tavares, PFL, Bradaboy, Brad Cooper and PFL. So he's like, the Hawaiian wave has started, paddle hard. So I was like, okay, that's really dope, Hawaiian wave. And then at Bellator Hawaii, at the beginning of the third round, you hear the crowd just start cheering. And I even looked up from my corner and I saw that there was a wave going around the Blaisdell Arena. And that was the round that I finished Valerie. And so we said, hey man, we're gonna bring the Hawaiian wave up to San Jose. I do a lot of underwater training in preparation for my fights. And I even became a certified underwater instructor. So water is super important. You know, water is life. There's even amongst the Native American communities, which I'm very closely connected to, you know, there's water protectors that are going to be escorting me out. And, you know, they're facing a lot of issues right now trying to get clean drinking water, you know, with the DAPL, no DAPL pipelines. So, water just seemed like the obvious choice for this fight. And then we even found out that SAP Center is also known as the Shark Tank.
Sure.
Because the hockey team, which is really awesome, because my nickname for my underwater training is the Bull Shark. Mm-hmm. So it's just like all of these things were kind of synchronized. And even today, somebody tagged me in like a picture of a shark with a pineapple. And this is like a real picture, because I guess a bill just passed in Hawaii protecting sharks. So it's just, I was like, oh my gosh, it's all synchronized, synchronicity, you know? So that's the theme, water. You guys will definitely, there'll be a very meaningful walkout like always this Saturday at the Shark Tank.
How has your life changed since the Hawaii show? And as far as like being in Hawaii, kind of like, I mean, you know, you kind of became like a celebrity there, I would think, just coming off of that event. How did everyone kind of like look at things? You know, someone from the area coming back, winning the champion or retaining the championship, actually.
Yeah.
But headlining a big time. You know, there were two nights, but your mm-hmm. your show was like really the big main event of the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. I love Hawaii. I love the people, and I always say too that Hawaii, we really truly have the best fans in the world, because, well, one, we're probably all related, so we're like, oh yeah, that's family. But two, like, they are not your bandwagon fans, you know, despite whether we win or we lose or we get knocked out in the first round or we're a world champion, they will have our backs to the end. They are ride or die fans. And so, I'm very grateful for Hawaii's support. When I do go home, I get recognized here and there, but it's not anything crazy. It's definitely not like max level. In fact, I was actually super butthurt because I guess the week after my fight was the Aquaman premiere. Mm-hmm. And like, so all the fighters got invited except for me. And I'm like, excuse me, I just fought Bellator Hawaii. Are you not even going to invite me to the little like pre-party show? So I was a little butthurt, Jason Momoa, if you're listening to this. But otherwise, yeah, it's still chill whenever I go back home. It's not anything crazy.
Now, as far as like training goes and everything like that, I mean, what have you kind of like learned in as far as like being a champion as opposed to grinding to become a champion? Or is it just everything the same and you still have the exact same mentality?
Oh, I definitely see the difference. And it's really interesting, too, because all of our camps are different. And I remember the camps where that they did increase in intensity. It was my first fight against Emily Ducote that, for some reason, my coach just made our camp, like, raise a few notches. And even Liz, who did that camp with me, she's like, that was pretty intense. So if Liz Carmouche is saying that, then we know that's intense. And I look back at that camp and I'm like, that was nothing compared to my champ camps, you know? So if anything, I just feel like my mindset has changed. I know exactly what's expected of me in training to be at that championship level. And so, yeah, like I actually had a really great camp this time, and a lot of my teammates were like, dude, your cardio is crazy. Like, you just went on a six week long hiatus and then came back and you're able to like do all the hill sprints and everything. And I'm like, it's mental, guys. It's all mental. So yeah, I feel like that mentality is not going to leave me. I'm always going to have that championship level mindset in everything I do. And yeah, like I know exactly what's expected of me now.
You know, when it comes to like the weight and things like that, I mean, is that easy? I mean, it's never easy, but is it mentally easier?
Yes and no. So that was the only thing that was bothering me this camp. And it was annoying because, like I said, my cardio was the best it's ever been. And I'm just like, well, then why am I still fat? Like, I don't understand. Why is the weight not coming off? So we think that maybe I didn't have enough time off, because normally I fight every 6 months. But this time it was like a 4 month turnaround. But of course, my weight started coming off this week. I'm only 5 pounds out now, so we're good. So as far as the weight goes, like, yeah, I think I just stress myself out too much, but I need to stress about something during fight camp, you know? So, and yeah, the weight cuts, no matter how good your weight is, it's never going to be fun. Yeah. So I can't wait for the day where I'm like, I'm going to bantam weight, so I don't have to cut like 20 pounds.
I mean, as far as that goes, I mean, are you looking for that day where you go to 135, or is it just...
I think if Bellator opened up the 35 division, I would want to try to go for champ. I want that champ status like Bader does. So for sure, if Bellator opened up, I would.
Mm-hmm. And what's, you know, as far as like, are you looking at trying to fight every 4 months, or is it just kind of like what they, you know, now that you've got some recognition and everything with them and they're putting you on the DAZN shows, are you just kind of like, are they kind of like going like, hey, we want you to fight more often?
No, I definitely have some autonomy now, but I actually asked them, can I fight before June? Because June is actually my high school 10-year reunion. And a lot of people think that's really lame, but I'm like, oh, you didn't go to our high school. I went to Punahou.
Yeah,
which is like the Hogwarts of Hawaii. So I'm definitely looking forward to my high school reunion. You know, all of my classmates came to my fight in Hawaii. I go and see my school every single time I'm home. I make sure to go visit campus and go see my teachers. I even like talked to the students last time, fight week, you know. So it's a very, very special place to me. And yeah, I want to party at my 10-year reunion. So I was like, I need a fight before June 7th. So they're like, all right, we got the San Jose show. So yeah, I was down for it.
So now, where have you fought in the United States? As far as I'm trying to remember. I
mean, so we did Pechanga, Fresno,
okay,
San Jose, Oklahoma, Mohegan Sun. Super random.
Yeah. So what's it, as far as like, you know, you've been here before, you were at the last show. I mean, San Jose's got a unique atmosphere when it comes to fighting too, and a great fighting history. So, you know, is there any kind of thoughts as far as San Jose in specific?
Yeah, so I was really excited when I found out I was going to fight here, because I consider it kind of like Bellator's headquarters.
Yeah, it's a home basis here.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know, and it does have a long fighting history with Strikeforce and everything. So, which I just learned this fight week. But yeah, and you know, like when I came here for that September show, I was just like, dude, this is awesome. This is a really cool atmosphere. Even downtown San Jose, there was a karaoke ice cream truck. It was like a food truck with ice cream with karaoke. And I'm like, I love this place. And it was in one of these parks like near the hotel. So it's just, yeah, again, a really cool vibe up here. And, yeah, I was excited to find out that I was going to fight here finally, because, you know, they always have the tentpole shows here as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would love to come back to San Jose.
What's it like living in San Diego?
It's amazing.
Yeah, because I mean, San Diego is like one of my favorite cities to go. You know, just perfect weather year round type of thing and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing down there. I mean, it's really not that different from Hawaii. So I'm glad I chose San Diego State and not like.
So you went to college there?
Yeah, that's how I ended up in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
And I was actually saying earlier in the media scrum that I got into USF up here, and I got into UW and UNLV. So it was like between those four colleges. I'm like, well, San Diego State is the cheapest, so I'm going to choose there.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy I did, obviously. I think I was meant to be in San Diego. It's a great, great city. I have tons of family down there. My first cousins are all over there. So, you know, and I'm actually like, I'm in escrow right now. I'm getting a house in San Diego. It's my home base. Even though Hawaii is my home, that's where my heart is. That's where my family is. I go back to Hawaii all the time anyway. So, but San Diego is my home base.
So now, how did you get into fighting? I mean, was it at what point was it a goal? Because did you grow up wanting to be a fighter, or did it just
hell no?
Yeah, no.
Did you
start training more for recreation, if that's the right word, or
yeah, for health? So, yeah. I actually grew up playing basketball. Basketball was my first sport. I wanted to go to the WNBA. Like, I wanted to go to college and play basketball. But then I actually tore my ACL. I had to get a few surgeries on my knees. And so basketball was out of the question, but I was still able to wrestle. So I had been wrestling too that entire time.
That's right. You wrestled. You were like state champion wrestler.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So after those knee injuries, I gave up the dream of playing basketball in college, just stuck to wrestling, got offered a scholarship to Menlo for wrestling, which is actually where Carla Esparza, Ashley Evans-Smith
went. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but
that's right by here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't, I was like, no, I don't want to. I felt like I was never going to play sports again after high school. So I went to SDSU, partied super hard, got my weight, went up to 175 my freshman year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And just for some perspective, I walk at 140 and I fight at 125. So that's like a 50-pound difference.
Mm-hmm.
I got really big in college. And once I finished my my bachelor's, I was actually waiting to get into a grad program. I was just going straight into a graduate program. I decided, like, you know, I have this summer off. It's time to do something. So I had actually joined a CrossFit gym and an MMA gym, which was Liz Carmouche's gym. And I was like, I'm just going to do both of these. And then whichever one I like, I'm going to stick with. And so that's how it started. Just for me wanting to lose weight and get in shape. And, you know, slowly my coach, Manolo Hernandez, he was like, hey, dude, I think you want to try, like, do a little smoker at the gym. I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever. So I do that. I do a couple of those. And he's like, do you want to maybe do like an amateur fight in the local circuit? Yeah, whatever. So I do like 9 of those. And then he's like, hey, I think you should just go pro already. You should probably be getting paid. And at the time, I was still in my grad program. And so I was like, okay, I'll do this just to say bucket list, you know, so I can show my kids like I did one pro fight.
Yeah.
And then that was the soccer mom fight. And then that's when Bellator called.
Oh, after one fight.
Yeah, after one fight. And I was also, I had just received my master's degree. I had finished the program early. So I had a few months before, like, I would start looking for a big girl job. And that's when Bellator called. So I actually called my parents. They're the first ones that I called. And I was like, Mom and Dad, I know you guys just spent all this money to put me through college, but like, how would you feel if I started fighting for a little bit, you know, just to see how it goes? It's a 3-fight contract and won't be long. And surprisingly, they were actually really supportive. They were just like, go for it. You're young, do it while you're able bodied. You can always fall back on your degrees. So that happened 4 years later, like, and here I am. So that's how it started.
So it was like, you know, because a lot of people, you know, it's like it's their childhood dream and things like that. And for you kind of fell into it.
We call me the accidental champ at the gym. Yeah, definitely fell into it. But I feel like it was part of the plan. Like, I really do believe in destiny. And, you know, I'm all like into crystals and tarot cards. So I'm like, oh.
At what point did you mentally say, I'm a fighter? I mean, you know, like, okay, I am a fighter and I'm a good fighter.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, man, it took me a long time. I was very resistant to it because I was like, I wanted to be a teacher. How did I end up here? So it really wasn't until the Rebecca Ruth fight where, and that was like my third fight with Bellator. And after I won that, I was like, oh, okay, like, I can do this. And then the next fight after that was with Emily Ducote. And that was the fight that I was like, okay, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to quit my job waiting tables and just focus on fighting. And then it wasn't until I actually won the belt that I was like, okay, this is my career. Like, this is what I'm going to do.
Do you have a time frame for this? Like, and a next step? Or is this, or you just kind of ride this and then when the next step comes, it comes?
So I always thought that I wanted to fight till I was 30. So I just turned 29. And it actually coincides with the end of my contract when I turn 30. And I always put that timeline there because I'm like, you know, I want to start having babies and start a family. But that's like totally not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even have a boyfriend. So I'm like,
you don't have time for a boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll say that. I don't have time for a boyfriend. So yeah, I'm like, yeah, kids I can hold off on that. I'm doing well in the career. So why would I stop? So, yeah, we'll see what happens, after this next year when my contract is up. I mean, I would love to continue fighting if my body is still able to. So we'll see.
How's the body feel right now?
It's fine. It's totally fine. Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I'm one of the very fortunate fighters that actually have not suffered like a mitigating injury in any of like so far. So I'm knock on wood. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
And good luck on Saturday, and we'll be seeing you in the future.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay. So we're back. I was very impressed with what Fitch said. He seemed really honest and.
He's got a tough fight this week.
Got a tough fight, but he almost, there were times in his career where I'm sure he was unhappy with things, but he seems like he's in a really good place right now.
I guess. I mean, he's won 5 in a row, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, at his age, you know, you would think that, I mean, things may change. I mean, he's still at the tail end of his career.
Right.
You know, even if he goes on a little bit of a run at 41, you know, your time is running out in this sport, well, especially as a welterweight.
Because, and then he was saying how he almost wishes they could do the three fights in a, like on the same night, because he knows that it's going to be a grind for the rest of the year to get all those fights in if he does win.
Well, the thing is, the winner of that fight is going to fight, unless they're hurt, and I think that's going to be a tough move for either one, is supposed to fight at MSG on June 14th, and then they want the finals in September. You know, I mean, if he wins three fights, he makes $1 million, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
The odds in that category of him winning the three is tough. It's tough for, you know, like for anyone. This is not like that heavyweight tournament where Ryan Bader is going to run through everybody because he's just younger and better than everybody else.
So we talked a little bit about Fitch in the intro, so I'll get to Alima Lay. But she has a certain charisma about her.
Absolutely.
That really works. And it just made me wonder, because she had mentioned a couple times that, you know, this was not something that she thought about she was going to get into, but now she's getting a little older and she doesn't know, you know, sort of what the end game is.
I got to say this. Okay. She got signed to Bellator after one fight. Now, she won the fight in 10 seconds, but you have to. Now, this is one where I don't know if it's Scott Coker, Rich Chow, you know, who made the call. But you got to give them a lot of credit, because that's, again, you know, someone who's 1-0 working on like a show in San Diego. You know what I mean? It's just whether they saw, you know, whatever they saw, the charisma. I mean, it's like I can see the charisma, but she's deep in her career. I can't say I saw it the first time I saw her fight. I definitely saw it before she won the championship. And then it was clear to me a couple fights back. And in Hawaii, it was off the charts. Mm-hmm. But it's like they saw it in one fight. To give someone a three-fight contract that's only had one fight. Granted, you know, the depth in the women's division, you know, in the women's division is not as deep as the guys. There aren't as many. So you get someone who's a good athlete, and I think they want pretty girls. I think that's obviously everyone wants that, But, you know, in the end, you still got to win your fights. I don't care how good looking you are. They can't protect you at a championship level. They can to a degree, but they really can't. Not in this sport. So, they lucked into, you know, and that's the thing. You know, with the pro wrestling, you see somebody like this, you can make them world champion and you can protect them, right? In this one, you know, you got to pray that Conor McGregor actually wins these fights. And I mean, and sometimes, a lot of times they don't. But, you know, I'm not trying to say Yalima's Conor McGregor, but she's still a star.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, she's very, very savvy. She's super smart.
Yep.
You can hear the thing and tell she's super smart. And if you watch the way, like the thought that she puts into her entrances and things like that, it's like she's got the whole picture, which, you know, so many of the fighters don't have.
Right. Yeah. I thought very much the same way. And just the thought process, and it reminded me a lot of pro wrestling in the sense of her thought process of the entrance videos and the themes to her fight, the presentation.
The themes in the presentation.
Presentation is such a big thing to her.
You could see it. I mean, look how long she talked about it. It's one thing in Hawaii when I think that in her mind, she visualizes all this stuff. Well, she visualizes her fights too. She visualizes how everything's going to go. And I mean that the Hawaii thing, it's like, you know, the whole Hawaii fight was like, that whole night is like this dream sequence. Like I kind of wrote about it tonight and it was like, you know, it was like, you know, your climax of your movie. You know what I mean? I mean, that night, I mean, I'm watching it going like, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
Yep.
It couldn't have gone more perfect. I mean, every single thing about it, it was like, you couldn't script it any better, you know, and that's Bellator luck and knew it. And, you know, her winning the fight, you know, if she lost the fight, all that other stuff, that great entrance, everyone would have forgot about
right,
it.
Right. Right.
You know, it would have been, it's cool for the moment, but she lost the fight.
Yeah, no, it was good stuff. And we will be there on Saturday. And are you doing the play-by-play or how's that working?
I'm going to do it for the site, yeah. And then I would presume I'm going to be doing some stories after, you know, and we'll do a show that night. Brian and I are going to do the show.
Yeah, Brian will be here.
Brian's going to be here Saturday night. So because he's wrestling in Union City, which is not far from here. So we'll all do the show together Saturday night.
All right, so for the non-subscribers who are listening to this because it's out there for free, f4wonline.com, wrestlingobserver.com, and obviously the Wrestling Observer newsletter is one of the main things on the website.
This is going to be a killer issue this week going through this. I'll go through those financials like in depth. There's a lot to them. But yeah, it was, there's always something and there's always stuff that's kind of being hidden and all this, but this was the single most concerning quarter I've seen in years.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, I know, I'm like, I follow it every week. I know the house shows are down and all this, but when it really hits you, you know, and again, you're talking about a quarter that had probably a $3 million gate with the San Antonio Royal Rumble, and it's still way down. It's like, I thought, well, the Rumble is going to artificially make these house shows look like it's might be down a little, but it's not going to look too bad. Even with that,
yep,
it looked bad.
And you and Brian do usually a minimum of about three Wrestling Observer Radios a week.
Three or four a week. And then me and you do one or two.
Yeah, we do. We do a couple here and there. Brian and Vinny shows, lots of other audio on the website as well. So if you are not a subscriber, give it a chance. Check it out. You'll learn something for sure.
Yeah.
All right. For Dave, I am Garrett. To everyone, thanks for listening.